This is Will's Band of the Week for August 3rd, 2014. Welcome to another edition of Will's Band of the Week. This is Will, along with Chris from an undisclosed remote location.
I'm here.
Barrett is hiding from, he's out of Wi-Fi range.
Undisclosed location.
Exactly, right. He can't even be tracked. Maybe, could the government track him? Probably.
His phone
has, I'm sure it's got a code on it.
He's out hunting the most dangerous game, man.
Do you know that Big Brother is out to get you? I paid for something the other day, and I gave my card to this was a pizza place in town, and I gave them my card to pay for it, and it just popped up on their screen, and it had my email and everything, and they sent me my receipt by email, and I thought, so somehow it knows that my card is tied to my email, and it just did it.
Mm.
I don't even know how it did it, so...
My wife the other day logged into our account, our healthcare account, to check, one of our records or something, and up pops a picture of her that was taken the last time she was at the doctor's office, when she's standing up at the thing.
Uh-huh.
So they apparently have this hidden camera that takes a picture of you while you're checking in for your appointment, and then that becomes part of your record.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And there's some kind of face recognition software. So if somebody said they were her, they would be like, Yep. Well, we're entering a new era. We've already entered. We entered the new era 10 years ago, but we're now just realizing it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, it's a nice, warm, sunny day here in the Midwest. And we're going to talk about music again, right?
Indeed we are.
Is there any music news?
You know, I've spent the last couple of days fuming about this this article that was on Slate, which is, it's entitled Why REM's Out of Time is the Most Politically Significant Album in U.S. History.
Yes, I saw the link to that a week or two ago, and I started to read it, and I'm just like, I don't get it, so
this,
I'm not going to read it anymore.
This is kind of like what Slate is famous for, is their stock and trade that they do. They'll do, some article that completely makes no sense just to get people like me, suckers like me, to click on it and complain about it and talk about it on podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
But this is absolutely preposterous. I mean, obviously I'm second to none in my love of REM, and we've done plenty of podcasts and such. But basically their argument is that this is the most politically significant album in U.S. history because on the back of the packaging, there was a card you could send in to join Rock the Vote. And that got more young people involved in politics, and Michael Stipe did a TV ad and all that stuff. Now, what it fails to mention, this is clearly written by someone who probably wasn't of sentient age in 1991 when the album came out. The fail to mention was, in the presidential election after that in 1992, and then again in 1996, the voter participation was at its all-time low in American history. In the Bush Clinton and then the Clinton Dole, it dropped to levels pre-1920s levels. So it actually had nothing to do with getting people out to vote. Voter turnout was actually down quite a bit. And you just look at some of the albums just off the top of your head that are politically significant. 2 years earlier, Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, was far more politically significant at the time. I mean, you look at all the albums that caused all the ruckus with the parental advisory lyrics, and they make reference to this in the article, but you had Twisted Sister up there testifying in Capitol Hill, about Satanism and music and all that kind of stuff. And then you go back and even albums I think that were not meant to be political, I would even think Queen's albums actually had an effect on gay rights in some respect. I mean, Freddie Mercury, it was no secret what he was up to. And then, you know, even the albums of all the anti-war albums of the 60s. And then you had, you know, Marvin Gaye's albums about living in the inner city and things like that. I would say all of those are far more politically significant than REM's Out of Time. So I don't know. This article did its job in getting me outraged and talking about it. So kudos to them.
The other thing they do is they put intentionally misleading headlines on things. Yeah. Like I really like the Slate. A lot of their podcasts, I think, are great. And the writing is, you know, it's usually good writing. But the if you follow their Twitter, they'll put a thing up there and it's a complete purposeful misdirection, right? And then you read the article and it's like the point of the article is the opposite. So I don't know if could this person really be serious that they thought that REM album was that influential? Yeah. I didn't read enough of it, so I don't know if they were going for misdirection there or not. But
yeah. Anyway, tirade over.
Yeah.
And I love the album.
What do you think about, you know, now looking back on that whole Tipper Gore with the albums thing, the, you know, the stickers on the albums and stuff? I just remember how outraged everybody was. And I think back on it now and I'm like, was that really that big of a deal? They just wanted to put stickers on. But or were they trying to legislate that you had to put a sticker on? I can't even remember.
Yeah. And I don't believe it's actually is legislated. I think it was just the music industry doing it on their own.
So there was a group of people, parents, that thought that their kids were going to get corrupted if they listened to Black Sabbath or whatever, or Twisted Sister.
Yes.
And so they were lobbying the industry to, but weren't there legislative hearings on it?
It became a government thing. Dee Snider of Twisted Sister up testifying in front of Capitol Hill because Tipper Gore. Let's see, was it the PMRC, the Parents and Media Research Center or something? I don't know.
Parents Music Resource Center, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I think it was PMRC.
I mean, it was just funny. You'd hear these stodgy old white guys reciting lyrics during these Capitol Hill hearings. It was just one of the most bizarre things you'll ever see.
Yeah, and I can't really remember what the whole source of the outrage was. I mean, obviously, like teenagers listening to music, they don't want it to be censored. So I guess that was the whole thing, is that then if their parents wouldn't let them buy an album that had a sticker on it, they'd probably be concerned about, right?
So, right. And the lyrics that they were talking about were so tame by today's standards. I mean, it was only probably 10 years later when Nine Inch Nails' Trent Reznor had a song where, you know, the refrain was as filthy as you could possibly get, and it like went to number one. It was the most popular album in America. So, I mean, it was almost an attempt to not have it played anywhere in public.
Right.
And yet it's still, and maybe that was the appeal, the counter appeal, that like, hey, look, we can get away with this.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the song Closer, of course. But.
You know, it's probably better now, right? There's very little, if any, censorship in music. And so you have Kanye West, like, going about as far as he can go and just open the whole thing up and it's all just ridiculous. And then at least, it seems to be, at least in my son's perspective, it's like, that works out just fine. Because he knows how ridiculous it all is. And it's like, if you try to put a ceiling on it, I mean, at a certain age, you might as well just forget about it, right? Because they've seen it all, you know? And you know, I guess if people are singing and like trying to get people to like kill themselves or something, it's one thing. But I don't know.
Right, Ice-T's Cop Killer was a big deal in like 1991.
Yeah, that's kind of bad. I guess you shouldn't do that. I'm against that.
I don't know, but I mean, you always can make the comparison between something like that and like what was going on in the movies all the time, though. I mean, you could go see movies where there were all kinds of cop killers and, you know, The Godfather and all kinds of stuff, and nobody really seemed to care about that. It was only when somehow music started doing it that people started getting really upset about it. Of course, movies always had for a long, long time, they've had a rating system, so you kind of knew what you're getting into.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just what they achieved with the stickers for music.
Yeah. Wasn't Frank Zappa in on that, too? Why am I thinking
believe Zappa was involved somehow.
Yeah. what a character. All right. So, well, there's a new album to talk about, maybe a couple. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, we've both listened to this band called Always, and it's spelled wrong, so you should know that right away. There are two V's in there instead of a W. And I think they said that they named it that way because there was a conflict with another band, but I'm not sure. Maybe it was one of those Google-friendly things too, right?
Well, if you think about the word, the letter W is pretty lazy anyway. It's like, come on, English language. You already got a U, now you just do a W? I mean,
yeah.
Come up with another name.
It is kind of, yeah, yeah. So why not? I'm going to let him do it. Sometimes I'm not a big fan of the misspelling thing, but I don't know. I guess this one's okay. I don't mind it. So, well, I really like this album. Let's just say that right out in front.
You just gave it away.
I gave it away now. It's like, you guys can stop listening now because you know I like it. And I got a little preview from Barrett. He thought that it was a little too derivative for him. And but he thought that one song was super catchy to the point that he wanted to play it again after playing it.
Yep.
So let's play that one. It's super catchy. It's called Archie, Marry Me. That's Always. Archie, Marry Me. The album is self-titled, Always. And you know what? It was produced by indie rocker Chad Van Galen.
Mm.
A little interesting tidbit.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a Canadian band from, I believe, Toronto. So they're not from, like, Chad Van Galen is from Calgary, I think. Mm. So it's sort of like, you know, a long distance. But they have the Canadian thing in common.
Yep. So yeah. I'm sure Anurag has probably been on their career for years and years and years since they're from Toronto.
Yeah, we would hope so. Yeah.
It's interesting Barrett would pick that one. And it's funny, when I first looked them up on Spotify, that was like, that seemed to be the hit, like the,
right,
the song everybody seemed to like the most.
Yeah.
Because it's the first one that pops up.
Yep.
I actually think that is one of the lesser catchy songs on the album.
Wow. Well, I think it's one of the more catchy, but I do think that it's full of catchy songs.
Yes.
You know, and that's a good sign of a good album is when you can't decide what song to play. So I had that issue with this one.
And I know we have a rule against the first song of the album, but this one is just so crazy catchy that I've been playing it on repeat over and over. And also it has a video, which I linked to on Facebook, that I wanted everybody to see. It's funny, whenever I like link to a song on Facebook, nobody ever comments or watches it.
Yeah.
But I'm still trying to push my stuff on people.
Yeah, it's their problem. Yeah.
So yeah, I will pick Adult Diversion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep, catchy, no doubt about it.
I've probably listened to that song 50 times in the last week.
You know, it's not that common. I sort of agree with Barrett that it's kind of derivative, but I just really like it a lot. And it's not that common that you have a band that literally, to me, sounds like the combination, exact combination of two other bands. I think they're exactly a combination of Best Coast and Camera Obscura. Like, if you took those bands and put them together, this is exactly what you would get.
Yeah, even vocally sounds just like them. They're clearly a fan of those bands.
They have to be. There are some particular songs where the singer here of Always, her name is Molly Rankin, she has that same inflection as the singer for Camera Obscura. And it's like, mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. But she's good at the genre, and it's very worthy. So let's keep playing it. We could just play the whole album, right? Little pieces of it.
Sure. They won't mind.
I'm going to go with, there are just so many good songs. I like the track Party Police.
Ah, good. That was going to be my pick.
Yeah, that's great.
It's a filthy song. I wonder what the Parents Music Resource Center would have to say about that.
They probably wouldn't like it very much. There should be a sticker on this thing. Yeah.
Yep. Find comfort in debauchery.
Yeah.
Later, she says we can find comfort in biology. Gee, I wonder what she means by that, huh?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Molly Rankin?
Yeah.
Phil, incidentally, during that song, I looked up the Parents Music Resource Center.
Uh-huh.
And they released the Filthy 15, a list of the 15 songs they found most objectionable.
Like recently or like back then?
No, way back in the day.
Oh, okay.
It was Prince's Darling Nikki.
Oh, yeah, right.
Sex/masturbation.
Yep.
Sheena Easton's Sugar Walls. Judas Priest, yeah. Eat Me Alive. Motley Crue's song Bastard. I don't know. There's AC/DC, Let Me Put My Love Into You.
Yes. Gee.
Yeah. There's one of my favorite songs is from the Vinnie Vincent Invasion, and it's a song called, what's it called? Shoot You Full of Love.
Yeah.
It's like, geez, I wonder what those cryptic lyrics are about.
You know, I actually have two favorites in that whole category. There was a song by a band called Whitesnake called Slide It In. Do you remember that one? That was great.
I do not remember that
song. Okay, and then there was another one of those hair metal bands, and they had a song called "Tonight Long Stick Goes Boom."
Wow,
that's actually a song.
Nice.
You could probably find that on Spotify. Yeah,
it looks like the only requirement to be on this list is to be really popular. Like, I'm sure there are all kinds of, you know, like the Sex Pistols didn't make this list, or, you know, some of the more underground bands. You could say whatever you want about anything. But if you're AC/DC or you're Motley Crue or Madonna, who's on the list, then you make the list. Then suddenly you're objectionable. So their only real objection is being popular. So they're like the first hipsters, I think.
Yeah.
They don't like people who sell
That's
out.
That's right. That's a good point. Yeah. As long
you
as
know,
not...
I liked Twisted Sister before they got really popular and people started listening to them.
Right, exactly. They were so great before then, yeah. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? The whole, I think, just when you sort of make the comparison between reaction to sex and violence, right? Because look what's getting the objections are mostly to the sex stuff and more than, like, people killing each other. And it's the same way, like, all through culture, I think, with in American culture, that, like, blood and guts are totally fine. People being just bludgeoned to death and blood everywhere. But once you mention sex, it's like, whoa.
Wow, you're so very European.
Yeah. Yeah, that's me.
You may have, it may have slipped your mind that John Denver actually testified before the U.S. Senate against the PMRC.
He did, huh?
I think, if I recall correctly, I think his albums, he got a lot of heat because of songs like Rocky Mountain High.
Yeah.
Which are clearly about drugs.
Right.
So you don't really think of John Denver as being like one of the more salacious American music acts.
Right.
But apparently he was. He had to go testify in front of Congress.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, let's play another song from the Always album.
Sure.
You get another pick.
Oh, I do. Yeah. All right. Let me see. I got to look at my list here. I really like Ones Who Love You. This is the third song on the album.
Yeah, I'm on board with that one too. Always. It's full of hooks, isn't it?
Yeah, it's made for me.
Yep, me too.
Just
good one.
Get me anything in that genre, and the poppy girl band genre, and I'm in.
Yeah. Yep, well, two thumbs up from us, definitely.
Yep.
All right, everyone listen to that album. Of course, you've just listened to some of it, and if you didn't like it, then I suppose you shouldn't listen to it anymore. But
then a pox on all your houses.
Exactly. In fact, we'll disown you. We will disapprove of you listening to future podcasts if you don't like this album.
It is the most politically influential album of the last 50 years.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna vote this fall, having listened to that album.
You're gonna go vote in the Canadian elections?
Yeah, I could do that. Yeah. Even though I don't have no idea what the issues are, but that, who cares? All right. Well, boy, now anything we talk about now is gonna be a letdown. So, but we have to give the listeners more than like 20 some minutes, right? I mean, they got to get their $0 worth.
You know what? You want me to filibuster a little bit? I have a funny story.
Sure.
So I was reading this book last week, and it's an absolutely unbelievable book. It's called Charlatan by a guy named Pope Brock, and it is about a guy. It's essentially about like early 20th century, the 1900s, like medical quackery and all the stuff people used to get away with traveling around the country, because there was obviously no internet where these people couldn't be found out. So they'd go to one city and, you know, sell their snake oil, then move to another city and just kind of go on and on and on and make a good living. Well, there's this one guy who figured out how to implant goat testicles into humans, because apparently, like, so he's a snake oil salesman and he doesn't have a medical degree or anything. And some guy comes into him and he's like, you know, I wish I could like hump as much as those goats over there, because goats are apparently famous for their virility.
So
the guy starts this procedure where he implants goat testicles into men. And at the time, like, glands, testicles kind of had these like magical powers. People didn't really know. They thought they were like the fountain of youth, that they would rejuvenate you or whatever. So he starts this, and then he starts a radio station in Kansas, essentially. And this is the very earliest days of radio in the early 1920s. And he starts broadcasting essentially just these fireside chats where he talks about this procedure, this goat testicle procedure. And so he gets, I think, like 16,000 people have this procedure done. And eventually the Kansas medical board shuts him down. And the FCC shuts down his radio station because they recognize that this is all quackery. So what he does is he takes his radio station, moves it right on the border of Mexico and the U.S., and turns his signal so it plays all throughout the U.S. And he just goes ahead and does whatever he wants. But in the meantime, while he's doing these fireside chats, in between he would start playing like the earliest versions of country western music. So he would get these bands. One of them was the Carter family.
So
their first exposure to an American audience, like nationwide American audience, because the signal was so huge for this radio station, was through this goat testicle doctor who fled the law and set up in Mexico. A lot of these bands started getting their start. And so it was essentially the beginning of country music as a nationwide phenomenon was in the early 1930s when he went to Mexico and set up this huge radio station. So I thought that was a pretty neat tidbit. Like, just all the money that was made from this quackery at the time was really what kind of got radio stations up and running.
That is a crazy story. You know,
it
seems like that wouldn't even work. Like, you would think like just people would just die. Like, how could that even? I don't even get how you could do that procedure and like it could function in a human.
Well, about 50 people died in his in his care, like during the procedure.
Yeah,
which is why the medical people finally. The book is really good because it's kind of a cat and mouse game. It talks about this guy Morris Fishbein, who was the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. Mm-hmm. And so it's essentially a manhunt where he goes around the country trying to hunt this guy down. And, you know, this guy being a charlatan is really, you know, he's really gregarious and really he's kind of a man of the people. So everybody loves him. And so he's really, really crafty at trying to get around all the regulations. So it's really kind of a manhunt story of how they eventually get him. And it's just really interesting that all this money was made on a procedure that was clearly quackery. And I think like later they have a, you know, some kind of investigation where he has to testify what he actually did. And all along he had been saying that he would remove a man's testicles and then replace them with goat testicles. But when in fact what he would do is, and if you're squeamish, you might want to turn your podcast off right now. He would just slice open a male's testicle and then stuff the goat testicle in there, like almost like a testicle burrito, and then sew them up. And apparently a lot of guys, not only did it work, but a lot of these guys went on to have children even after the procedure. So,
but they were like half man, half goat, right?
Indeed. You know, they were out eating tin cans and things like that. So,
there's people in today's society now that have that in their ancestry, and they're like probably part goat.
I'm sure that's true. But I mean, the latent issue, the you know, through the whole book, that it's not really talked about, but it's clearly like people still fall for this kind of garbage.
Oh, there's just tons. There's still tons of medical quackery and
weight loss pills and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it talks about the days where you know, people would put these electric fezes on their head to try to help their alertness, and people drank radium in their water, which worked out. They felt great until their jaw started falling off.
It's everywhere, even with the internet. Like you said, you can really see how back then you could just travel from place to place. Nobody's ever heard of it, and just start over because you know people will just go for it. But even with the internet, people, if they don't choose to read or be educated, then you know the quackery still works. And you can go up to our local pharmacy and you can get like a wristband that's supposed to help motion sickness. It doesn't do anything.
Yeah, they've got them like these, the magnetic wristbands.
They're like, well, some people like these. Well, yeah, they do, but they don't work, so you probably shouldn't sell them. That's my opinion. I think the government should come down hard on them and prosecute the people. It is. It's really pretty bad.
Well, back in the 20s and 30s, I mean, it was just the golden era of quackery because, you know, you had these procedures that were now available, but there was really no regulation. Like, you'd have these kind of degree factories where people would go get these degrees that looked like medical degrees, and once you had one in one state, the reciprocity would you could practice in any state. And so there's like this one place in Arkansas that was just cranking out these degrees, you know, thousands of guys that would go around calling themselves doctors when they weren't. But even among like the, you know, the legitimate medical communities, like this guy Morris Fishbein went to the University of Chicago Medical School, I believe, which is, you know, a really good medical school. And one of his professors there comes up to him one day. He goes, "Hey, check this out." And he opens up his coat, and he's got some bumps on his ribs. And Fishbein is like, "Well, what'd you do there?" And he says, "Well, I had some like gorilla testicles implanted on my ribs." Like, what? This guy was a professor at a medical school, and he had this done.
Yeah.
So he just had gorilla testicles because they just thought, like, testicles were these magical fountains of power that all you had to do is just implant them somewhere in your body, and it would help you, you know, with your virility or whatever, or your alertness, or it was the fountain of youth or whatever.
Yeah, wow.
But it's just kind of interesting that the money made from these are essentially what started country music as like a national phenomenon, that it was actually channeled into something useful.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Well, that's just awesome. Let's talk about the proper ornaments. I bet you haven't even heard of the proper ornaments.
I have not.
Not many people have heard of the proper ornaments. But this, it sort of ties in with Always a little bit because it's either a side project or former members of a band called Veronica Falls. Do you remember those guys? That was another one of those really catchy power pop girl singer band things. And and so one or two people that I think were in Veronica Falls started this band called The Proper Ornaments. And it's definitely more leans toward the 60s pop kind of thing. And there's no girl singer, so it's, you know, you got to adjust to the male singing. So we'll see if we can adjust. Yeah. Yeah. So, but it has, some of it sounds like some of that 60s stuff that I liked a lot, or even like early 70s. And the album is called Wooden Head, and the band is called The Proper Ornaments. So let's play a song called Always. It's got Always in the title. Always There. the proper ornaments.
Yeah, kind of a slow surf jam.
Right, yeah. Let's play another one. We'll keep them coming.
I like it. Yeah, go on.
Summer's gone. You see it coming. Yeah, it is sort of slow surf. Maybe that's a genre that we could use to describe, you know, another, or another term we could use to describe a genre. I guess I kind of like surf. Slow surf. Yeah.
As good as fast surf.
Yeah. I think I'm playing more of the slow surf tracks here. It's not all slow surf like that, but those must be the ones I just gravitated to. We'll play one more from the Proper Ornaments. This one's called Stereo Lab. And rocked a little more.
Yeah, that's a little real estate-y, I think.
Well, they've got the jangle guitars that are a little bit of that nature. Maybe that's why,
right,
I like them.
I was going to say, because there's that one kind of real estate-y sounding lead guitar that kind of like drives the song.
Yeah.
I think that's something I've noticed about them. So.
Yeah, I think I'm going to invite these guys to my version of the Pitchfork Festival next year. My own alternative.
Wolfork.
Yeah. You know, I was noticing this. I was at the Frequency last night. It's Madison's most intimate rock and roll club, right? I think the capacity is 99. The place is tiny. But it's kind of cool because any band that you go see there, it's just totally in your face. And the sound system is good. And it's usually loud and it's fun. But I noticed in the bathroom, they've got all these posters for upcoming gigs. There's a band that played at the Pitchfork Festival called Twin Peaks. And I don't know anything about them. But they're going to be playing at the Frequency. And it's such a funny thing, isn't it? Like, you can play at a festival in front of thousands of people, and then you're in this little tiny club. You know, I guess it makes sense when you think about it, because the festival is like just bringing all the fans together in one place. But
well,
what a contrast.
A couple years ago when Barrett and I went to the Pitchfork Festival, you may recall that we saw a band in reverse do that. The Men, we went and saw at the Frequency.
Oh, yeah.
And then like 3 days later, Barrett and I went to go see him at the Pitchfork Festival in front of thousands of people. So, yeah, they did it.
I forgot that the Men played at Pitchfork. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of cool, though, to see a band in such different settings. But then again, it underscores my point that bands that get to play at the Pitchfork Festival should be like super happy and grateful. Because, come on, you know, you're this band that normally is playing little clubs and really small crowds. And here you are with an audience of thousands of people.
Well, as I mentioned last week, I watched the Twin Peaks on the web. And I liked them quite a bit. And I listened to their album, and I liked that quite a bit. So had it not been for the exposure they got there, I wouldn't have heard them. And I actually would probably want to go see them at the Frequency.
Well, maybe I have not even checked them out at all. I know nothing about them. So we'll have to consider that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Check it out.
So very good.
Yeah. Most importantly, my wife went and got these like mini bananas. And I don't know, I've been trying for a half hour to open one up, and I can't open it. And I don't understand the idea between the idea of a mini banana. Like, who has a banana and it's just like, you know what, this is way too much food.
Yeah.
This is way too big of a banana. We need to breed these mini bananas. And it's driving me crazy. So, on that note.
All right. Oh, I have one more music-related thing. Did you read that article about a week ago in the local paper about this woman who's been hosting shows in her basement?
No, I did not.
It's called Somebody's House of Sound. I'm forgetting the title of it now. It's her name, and then it's like, well, whatever. I can't remember the name.
Oh, yeah, something House of Righteous Music or whatever.
That's it, yeah. Is it Kiki's?
Yeah.
Yeah, Kiki's House of Righteous Music.
Right.
So
Eve Barsley played there a couple weeks ago, and I didn't go. That would have been my first time there.
And you know who's playing there? Coming up is the Baseball Project. That thing that Mike Mills is in from REM, and they all their songs are about baseball. They're going to be playing. So, you know, this woman just decided to start hosting shows in her basement. Now it's like they do, like, I don't know, it seemed like a couple a week or something. And apparently it's easier to do if you don't charge a fee. I don't even know how how rock music clubs work or anything. But they probably just have a voluntary or suggested donation or whatever, and they just put it on Facebook and say, we're gonna have this show. And then if you just tell them you're coming, they put you on the list and they give you the address. I guess once you've been there once, you know the address. But that's kind of low-key, but it's kind of cool. It seems to work.
But if you were Kiki's neighbor, how would you feel about the street being full of cars for a show at your house every couple of weeks?
That I don't know. Don't know how they deal with that. But
yeah.
Apparently, it hasn't been a problem thus far.
Yeah,
but
I'm all for it.
If you're like right in the middle of a busy block, maybe she's not. You know, she might be on in a less populated area. But anyway, kind of a cool concept, right?
Yeah,
yeah. We haven't had a live band here in Fourth Bedroom Studios yet. Barrett and I were talking about that. It would be pretty intimate. You know, it'd be like I remember when the Pains of Being Pure at Heart played in a bathroom, and they put a video up on Pitchfork. This is like
right.
5 years ago.
Essentially like playing in a closet.
Yeah. But you know, you get a great boomy sound out of the drums if you confine a full drum set to a small space. I think it's kind of cool though. All right, that's what we've got. That I hope the listeners feel like they've gotten their $0 worth. We're not going to get up to a full hour, but again, every minute, every segment of 5 seconds of this podcast is valuable. So we're not going to just waste time or waste the people's time, because we respect the listeners. So do you think we should talk to people again next week with another edition of Will's Band of the Week?
I think we should probably do that.
Yeah, I think we should. All right, good night.
Good night.
You can subscribe to the Will's Band of the Week podcast using iTunes or any other podcast app. All of our podcasts are also available directly on our webpage, willsband.net. You can contact us directly by email to willsband@yahoo.com, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter at Will's Band. The Will's Band of the Week podcast is brought to you every week from Fourth Bedroom Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Our theme music was composed by Grant and performed by Grant and Will. Thanks for listening.